Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse. Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
And the dignity of humanity requires living in peace, knowing that there's not going to be real quick destruction at any instant. Probably some of you listening to this may have seen the movie The Atomic Cafe. It was a documentary, which was also kind of a comedy, made in 1982. Enough time had passed since the end of the Cold War and fears of nuclear annihilation with the Soviet Union so that we could finally laugh at the silliness of the idea that fallout shelters could save us or that school children could duck and cover to be safe from a nuclear blast. In 1989, the Soviet Union fell. The winner of the Cold War was us. The threat of war with Russia was finally over and done. We could breathe a big sigh of relief and move on. But believe it or not, here we are in 2016, and the U.S. is once again moving closer to war with Russia. You think this is ridiculous talk? I wish it were. According to more and more observers, there is a very real and growing danger of confrontation between Russia and the U.S., and it does seem that the U.S. is really pushing it, not Russia. Though not a lot of media has been paid to this growing threat. The entire reason for this return to a threat of nuclear annihilation rests with the neocons who gained tremendous power under George W. Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and that ilk, and have another full-throated advocate, I hate to say, in one Hillary Clinton. Now, just a few short years ago, an article written with a headline, United States Wants War with Russia, would have been unthinkable, patently absurd on its face. But with our attention focused elsewhere, there is, tragically, no lack of evidence that the headline and the subject absolutely deserves serious attention. Our guest today wrote the article in question. He is David Swanson, author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He's director of worldbeyondwar.org and campaign coordinator for rootsaction.org. David Swanson's books include War is a Lie. He blogs at davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org. He hosts Talk Nation Radio. He's 2015 and 2016 Nobel Peace Prize nominee. Thanks very much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive, David Swanson.
Hi, Bert. It's great to be here.
Well, we in the United States may not be aware of Russia's history of being threatened. They have a huge border, and they've been attacked over two centuries. If I understand history correctly, the Warsaw Pact, and I don't always, but the Warsaw Pact came out of the Second World War with the intention of being a defense against any expansion of NATO-pact countries. Is that correct? Do I read that history right?
Yes, absolutely. Russians were horrified and terrified of more attacks and wanted some sort of a buffer zone, of a warning space and protection from Germany and the West, set up a series of allies that would work together to put some space between the next attack and Moscow.
President Obama recently went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and a lot of historians looking at why the U.S. dropped the nuclear bombs there was not so much to destroy Japan and to win the war. It was that, but it was also to show Stalin and to bring some fear of the U.S. right to Stalin. So they really had a lot to be afraid of.
I mean, it's not just some historians. It's historians in the way that scientists believe in climate change, with a few corrupt exceptions. I mean, it's overwhelmingly historians and first-person accounts. The majority of the five-star generals at the time, MacArthur, Eisenhower, Leahy, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I mean, they all said there's no need for this, it's not necessary, it's barbaric. You know, this is a crime against humanity. This is not something to end the war. All they had to do to end the war was to tell Japan, you can keep your silly emperor, which eventually they did, yeah, after dropping the bombs, which was a way to make sure that even with the demand for unconditional surrender and you don't get to keep your emperor, the war would end before you know, the Japan could surrender to the Soviets. Japan wanted, in fact, to surrender to the Americans before having to surrender to the Soviets, and to demonstrate two different types of bombs on two cities that hadn't been touched. So this was a demonstration, not an attack on the Japanese military, which wasn't in these two cities, and to kickstart the Cold War, which was, you know, not something that came along as another surprise attack on the innocent United States from the Soviet Union, but something created by President Truman and the U.S. government.
Yes, and now, I mean, you have to picture, Russia has a huge, huge border, thousands of miles long, and on the I guess it would be the northwest side are the Baltic states. And I understand, just as I was prepping for this show, which is being recorded on June 7th, that there are, that NATO is actually conducting military exercises in those countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And that's right smack on the border with Russia. And, you know, I ask people to imagine if you know, if Russia was doing that to us right on our border, say in Nova Scotia or British Columbia or something, we might be a little concerned as well, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, that's exactly the question to put to people. What would you think if the Cold War had supposedly ended and NATO had been dissolved and U.S. militarism had been scaled back and friendship had been offered to the world, and the Soviet Union had kept the Warsaw Pact in place, broken all promises to expand it to include Canada and Mexico and Caribbean islands and Bermuda and so forth, and put ships off the coast of the United States, put, you know, so-called missile defense, missile attack bases off the coast of the United States, threatened the United States by pulling out of arms reduction treaties in order to expand this weaponry, invested more in nuclear weapons, put nuclear weapons in these states near the United States, started talking about smaller, more usable nuclear weapons, facilitated coups in nearby countries, yes, as close to the United States as Ukraine is to Russia, you know, putting a Nazi government in power in one of those places, the Nazis, of course, being the last to attack the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union having, of course, been the force that defeated the Nazis. You know, what would the United States think of Russia? And instead, we hear, oh, a Russian plane has flown near a U.S. plane in the Baltic Sea, or a Russian plane has flown near a U.S. ship in the Baltic Sea. Well, you know, we don't have to learn, you know, the details and intricacies of treaties or find out exactly what the pilot's maneuver was. You know, we just have to get out a globe and find the Baltic Sea and see which coast of the United States it's on. Oh, actually, it's nowhere near this country. You know, it's not Russian aggression when the United States has put ships into the Baltic Sea and into the Black Sea and troops into the NATO members and quasi-members right up to the Russian border, pushing for a partnership with Ukraine and Georgia as well, big military exercises in Poland, missile defense, so-called, under construction in Poland and already completed in Romania, and Russia reacting as if this is a threat to its existence and threatening European nations if they continue to collaborate, and the U.S. public carrying on with, you know, election silliness and basketball and paying not the slightest attention.
If you just tuned in, Keeping Democracy Live!, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is David Swanson, author of a rather thought-provoking article that I'm sure people would rather not think about, and it's called United States Wants War with Russia. It seems absolute craziness to do that now. What? Where does this... I mean, let's back it up, I suppose, a little bit to talk about Ukraine, which is the most obvious example, one would think, if one looks at it. We in the U.S., of course, were presented with one picture of a revolution in Ukraine, people rising up spontaneously to overthrow a corrupt Soviet-style dictatorship in favor of what they really wanted, a greater alliance with the West. Was there, this was no threat at all to Russia as they presented it. What is wrong with this picture?
Well, it's not as if the previous government wasn't corrupt, and it's not as if well-meaning people didn't rise up, but it's a much more complicated picture than that, in that the United States worked to facilitate that coup and trained people to rise up violently and nonviolently, and this was a violent overthrow that put in place hand-picked leaders by the United States. You know, as we know from leaked audio of phone calls with the Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, and put in place a government that immediately started including numerous Nazi, and I don't mean Nazi in the sense that that John Kerry calls Bashar al-Assad Hitler or Hillary Clinton calls Vladimir Putin Hitler. I mean actually self-identified Nazis.
Yes.
In power.
The real thing.
And begin making moves to forbid the use of the Russian language and to discriminate against Russian-speaking people, which make up a large percentage of people, especially in the east of Ukraine. Ukraine means borderland. It's on the border. It's part Russian and part not. And you saw the people of Crimea after this violent coup, after they had lost a legitimate national government, people who had, you know, whose region there in Crimea had established, had long been part of Russia, now was part of Ukraine, but with autonomy and the right to set its own future, and took the opportunity and voted to become part of Russia again. And you had accusations from the U.S. media that Russia had invaded Ukraine and Russia had attacked Crimea. Russia, of course, had always had a military base in Crimea and sent in additional troops. But then you had story after story of a massive Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russia has invaded Ukraine, and it never happened. You had an airplane shot down and Russia blamed without evidence. And that story dragged on and on for months with any evidence hidden and no evidence put forward. All of this antagonization of Russia, the people of Ukraine having expressed very clearly in polls that they don't want to be part of NATO, you have further efforts with this new illegitimate government to bring Ukraine in as part of NATO. This is, you know, scaring the people of Russia, scaring the government of Russia, seen as aggression from the point of view of the Russians, but in the United States, it's depicted as aggression by Russia. You know, Russia, which, you know, had been trying to cooperate and show restraint and support the so-called global war on terrorism up until it refused to go along with the 2003 attack on Iraq and then became, you know, a force to be demonized in U.S. media, you know, facts notwithstanding.
Oh, interesting. That's a point. I've been trying to figure out how the heck did this happen, and what, you know, what are the political incentives, momentum that's pushing this forward? That, you know, when the U.S., as you pointed out, invaded Iraq in 2003, and they refused to go along, that must have made some neocons angry here in the United States. If you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. That's certainly when Russia began to be depicted very differently in U.S. media was when it refused to join the coalition of the so-called willing, the bribed and the threatened and the blackmailed nations of the world to attack Iraq. Russia wasn't going to go along with that. But, you know, you can read an article in the Politico magazine online or otherwise, this paper from Capitol Hill in D.C. From a few weeks back that has high-level Pentagon officials, albeit anonymously, stating that, you know, just as in decades gone by, all of the hype in the Pentagon about Russia's military superiority and the Russian threat and Russian aggression is all ludicrous nonsense and hype driven by the U.S. Army's desire for a reason to exist, and I would add NATO's desire for a reason to exist, and by the drive for profit, by the incredible amounts of money to be made off the weaponry needed to counter the Russian threat. Now, this, of course, while they're putting missiles, so-called missile defense bases in Romania and Poland, the Czech Republic having refused it, on the pretense of defending the United States from Iran. Right? And this not a year since celebrating the elimination of Iran's ability to send any missile anywhere, and the nuclear agreement with Iran and the oversight of Iran's non-existent nuclear weapons program, you know, that whole pretense that Russia never bought for a minute of putting these missiles into Eastern Europe as a defense of the United States against Iran, you know, it's fallen apart. They stuck with the same line as they continued to open these bases that Russia sees quite accurately as targeting Russia.
I don't know what else they could be. And, you know, the Warsaw Pact, as you point out, went away. But NATO expanded. When Germany reunited, the United States promised Russia that NATO would never expand eastward. What is the purpose of NATO, and why did they do that? What actually happened after the U.S. promised Russia that NATO would not expand eastward?
Well, NATO has a number of purposes, none of them admirable or legitimate. You know, for one thing, you can attack a place like Yugoslavia under the, I almost said the previous President Clinton, thus far, and let us hope, the only President Clinton, and pretend to have some sort of international legitimacy without Congress, without the United Nations, you know, without any legal cover other than NATO, which is completely under the thumb of the United States, and call it an international community. You can murder civilians in Afghanistan and call it a NATO operation and thereby put it out from under any oversight by the United States Congress. Not that there would be much anyway, but still, you know, you have this removal from any sort of responsibility to oversee criminal activities when you call it a NATO action rather than a U.S. action. You know, so NATO is a means of militarizing Europe, of requiring that European nations spend a certain amount of money on weapons, much of that money spent on weapons made in the United States by U.S. corporations. It's a means of putting U.S. weaponry and troops and bases in Europe under the cover of international collaboration, you know, a coalition effort rather than simply the United States.
Right.
And it's sort of a leftover from when it had a defensive excuse, but now it's used to attack places like Afghanistan and Libya and, you know, create death and suffering and refugee crises and destruction and chaos and weapons proliferation around the world, and call it humanitarian law enforcement, call it an international global defense operation, rather than simply U.S. aggression. And of course, NATO is largely the United States. Yeah. It is largely U.S. Funded, operated, driven, and directed. But it purports to be something else, to be European, and so to worm its way into European governments in ways that the United States can't. You couldn't sign up Eastern European nations as new members of the United States empire, but mm-hmm. you can sign them up as new members of NATO. Does it serve any legitimate purpose? I don't think so. I think it needs to be abandoned, as Donald Trump, of all people, blurted out before, someone told him that was unacceptable and he retracted it. You know, why is NATO still around? Can't we just get rid of it? You know, this is what occurs to anybody who first looks at the situation. I once had occasion where the Russian ambassador to the United States was speaking here at the University of Virginia, and I asked him, can we get rid of NATO? Does it have any legitimate purpose? And he very, very tactfully avoided directly answering the question, but clearly agreed and clearly believed that, as the facts seem to uphold, the United States promised when Russia agreed that Germany could reunite that NATO would not expand an inch eastward. And, of course, it's done so in a major way.
And what about the nations of Western Europe who are part of the coalition? Well, I don't know what they call it, but what about them? They're right there on the line, and they're allegedly participating in NATO. I know there have been some protests by some portions of the population in those countries. What about the governments of countries like Germany and the other countries that are participating in NATO?
Well, they're doing something that I believe is counterproductive on its own terms, the immoral and illegal and environmentally destructive and wasteful economically, and tending toward the erosion of our civil liberties and the quality of our society and our morality. Now, when a nation or a would-be nation like Scotland comes within inches of getting its independence, committed to leaving NATO and kicking U.S. nuclear submarines out of its country and refusing to participate in any more wars around the globe, you see a sign of what could happen with better representation of an enlightened public. It's not as if they've taken public polls in Germany or Italy or France or anywhere else and found public support for military spending and NATO membership and overthrows in Libya or Syria or Iran or anywhere else. Some of these governments are simply acting against the desires of the people in those countries.
Imagine that.
In those people's ignorance of what's going on. I spoke with an ally in the German peace movement recently who really shocked me by letting me know that a big chunk of the population in Germany doesn't even know that the U.S. troops are still there. That you've still got 50,000 or more U.S. troops never left Germany, still there since World War II. Not to mention 100,000 U.S. and British bombs still in the ground in Germany, still killing people year after year. People don't even know. But the people who do know, many of them are against it, and there's a huge movement growing in Germany to start with closing Ramstein Air Base in particular as central to the U.S. drone wars around the world and central to U.S. wars in Western Asia and the Middle East, that, this is not something that the German public wants, but it's something that the German government wants. This is This is the problem you run into in a place like the Czech Republic, where the government does a better job of representing the people.
Yeah, interesting. And I'm just thinking, I wonder about that base. What is it, Ramstein? Do they the drones leave from there and attack various places like in Somalia and Afghanistan, places like that? Because I could imagine people in those countries might figure out where the drones are coming from and be a little bit angry about that.
Yeah, the drones are actually piloted by, in each case, a pair of pilots, one nearby where the drone takes off and operates. The drones typically take off not far from where they operate. Some take off from Africa, from Djibouti and other locations. Most of the drone fighting that's happening in places like Afghanistan take off in Afghanistan. And so you have a pilot take off, lift the drone up into the air, and then the drone is taken over by a pilot in some place like Nevada or several other bases now around the United States.
But this is part of the NATO operation, I believe, right?
Well, NATO is, NATO is part of these wars, including the war in Afghanistan.
Yes.
The drones are operated, either by the CIA and the Air Force or by the Air Force, although the United Kingdom also has its own drones that are part of a NATO operation, such as in Afghanistan. But the communication links that connect all of these pilots and their robot killing machines, mm-hmm. and the satellites that provide the video is headquartered in this base in Ramstein, this Ramstein uh-huh. air base in Germany, uh-huh. Which is also right next to Landstuhl Medical Center Hospital. And so what does leave that area and come back are thousands and thousands of U.S. troops that come back often in horrible condition, brought to this hospital in Germany before they're brought, if they survive, back to VA hospitals in the United States. But the drone connection is not that the drones are flying from Germany. It's that the communications hookups between the drones and the satellites and the pilots and the commanders watching the video, is all based there in Germany.
And the obvious question is, what the heck would be the motivation for the new aggressive stance against Russia? And there's a lot to look up there. I mean, I guess that goes back to the neocons, which is a term that, everybody's heard neocon, but people, I think, are not exactly sure what neocon means. My understanding is that it's strictly relative to foreign policy, to this kind of thing, to the aggressive new foreign policy. Tell us about the neocons and what the definition of that term is and what they're after, you think, and how much of this, the neocon, are behind the new aggressive stance against Russia.
Yeah, this was a name that a group came up with for itself back in the 1990s, if not earlier, a new type of conservative that, unlike sort of a dictionary definition of conservative, was in favor of a radically expanded imperialism and military attacks on numerous nations and the overthrow of governments come chaos or friendly puppet state, come what may. And if you look at the foreign policy actions and positions of someone like Hillary Clinton, she fits the definition perfectly, which is why some of us set up a website called HillaryIsANeocon.com that also quotes many of the self-identified neocons who are backing her and supporting her, people like Robert Kagan and Dick Cheney and Henry Kissinger and on and on through the extreme right wing of foreign policy establishment in Washington, D.C. Hillary Clinton is their candidate, not Bernie Sanders, not anybody else. Does the motivation for, aggression toward Russia arise out of, a new concoction from the 1990s and the 2000s? I'm not so sure. I think that when, the British sent Scottish settler colonists to massacre the Irish and take over Northern Ireland and paid money for Irish heads and then sent them to the New World and paid money for Native American scalps and insisted on the white race's responsibility to kill and slaughter and convert and take over the rest of that continent and anywhere else they could get to. And that imperialism rolled on and on, uninterrupted through, waves of increase and decrease, but no, real reversal right up to the current day. So that, during the Cold War, the excuse for the pursuit of global domination was the Soviet threat, the communist menace, so that when the Cold War supposedly ended, there were people, good-meaning people, anti-war people, who actually thought all the wars were going to stop. All the U.S. aggression in Latin America and Africa and Asia was at an end. And then it rolled on, and people said, oh, well, the wars were driven by the communist threat up until 1989, and since then they've been driven by some other threats.
Right.
All of which is to sort of miss the key point that the United States has been pursuing the domination of the globe since before there was a United States. And when the troops are thanked for watching the basketball game in 175 countries and nobody blinks, you have to stop and ask what in the world they're doing there and which countries aren't in that list, because there are fewer than 200 significant countries in the world. And the ones that are putting some sort of resistance, some sort of independence, that are not making themselves part of a U.S. empire, well, those are the ones against which, the remaining aggression is directed. And Russia, first and foremost, which is, the only country with a significant military with bases outside its borders, in Syria in particular,
yes.
A country with massive amounts of fossil fuels to be looted, the only country that can begin to justify, the Pentagon spending as a legitimate, powerful enemy. That's where the aggression goes, but the aggression isn't anything new.
Fascinating. It goes on and on and on. If you just tuned in, Keeping Democracy Alive is the show. I'm Bert Cohen. Our guest today is David Swanson, author, activist, journalist. He's written an article, "The United States Wants War with Russia." It seems so absolutely crazy, but there's a lot of evidence that this is happening. And I will tell you, I went to a presidential debate in New Hampshire in December, and I heard one of the candidates, Hillary Clinton, call for a no-fly zone over Syria. Now, the reality is ISIS, who I think we all recognize, Russia recognizes, is a bad guy. ISIS has not one airplane. Russia flies over Syria often in their war against ISIS, which is, I believe, reasonably effective. Could she have intended to be provocative against Russia by that statement? It just amazes me. I mean, a no-fly zone over Syria. ISIS has not one plane, but Russia's there all the time. I have to believe she knows what she's doing and that this is just part of the whole neocon aggressive stance against Russia. It's just bizarre to me. What do you make of it, David?
Well, I don't think we have to, guess at secret desires to antagonize Russia. I mean, this is someone who has compared Vladimir Putin to Hitler, who is constantly raising the idea of Russia as an evil empire and herself as someone as courageous and militaristic as required to stand up to Russia, as if Russia is somehow threatening the United States. But this is, someone who has backed sort of humanitarian excuses for aggressive war for decades at every opportunity, and who says that President Obama was wrong and horribly wrong not to bomb every inch of Syria in 2013 when he and John Kerry put up that campaign for, you know, missile strikes into Syria, and the public said no and
right.
stopped it. Hillary Clinton, despite her, you know, pretense of being the one to continue every horrible thing Barack Obama has done, you know, opposes publicly that good thing he did in reversing his decision and not bombing Syria. You know, with a bombing campaign that probably would have put ISIS in charge of all of Syria. Now you have ISIS and other fighters, terrorist groups in Syria that the U.S. has provided directly and indirectly, intentionally and accidentally, with huge amounts of weaponry, including anti-aircraft weaponry provided, and a big push to provide more anti-aircraft weaponry to terrorists in Syria. While, as you say, ISIS has not yet developed the airplane, and the airplanes in the sky are Syrian or Russian or United States or other civilian aircraft that could be shot down. You know, when George W. Bush wanted to attack Iraq and was pretending that he didn't, that he was being forced into it as a last resort, so he might have to go and aggressively attack Iraq because we might have no other choice somehow. He had a meeting on January 31st, 2003 with Tony Blair, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, in the White House, where he came up with all sorts of cockamamie schemes for how he could get the war started while pretending not to. One of them was, Bush said to Blair, let's paint UN colors on airplanes and fly them low over Iraq and try to get them shot at.
Yeah.
That could start the war. And then they walked out, Blair and Bush, and did a press conference. You can still watch the video of the press conference where they act as if they don't really want a war in Iraq, they just might be forced into it. And here you've got people in Washington talking about giving more anti-aircraft weaponry to people on the ground in Syria, just as they did in Afghanistan in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Started this whole madness. And what do you think's going to happen? Nothing good.
Right.
Possibly a new excuse for a war. You know, just as an airplane shot down in Ukraine became an excuse for more hostility toward Russia. And yet this is what Hillary Clinton says she wants, and she wants a no-fly zone, which sounds like some sort of diplomatic effort. No, a no-fly zone is a criminal act of war. It is bombing anything that could shoot down an airplane except for the people you've given anti-aircraft weaponry to, and then declaring a no-fly zone and bombing anything that seems to be a threat to it. And you can call it a safe, she now calls this a safe zone, you know, but it's a criminal act of aggression to take over the sky of another nation's nation. And this is, you know, what the liberal Democratic would-be nominee wants to do.
Oh, I have a hard time calling her a liberal. I can't. It's just not the case in any way. But she certainly. But Syria. All right. A lot of people say, why is Russia backing this horrible dictator in Syria? What are they doing there? And they're actually, Russia is fighting against ISIS, I believe. And, you know, the other part of Syria, the people that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton wanted to arm, most of those weapons would go pretty much immediately to ISIS. I mean, there's like no organization there whatsoever. I mean, the weapons would just slip there. But talk about Russia and Syria and how maybe the U.S. is perhaps talking about that as some reason to be aggressive. Maybe there really isn't a reason to be aggressive when it comes to Syria. Talk about that, please, David Swanson.
Yeah, well, you know, the former Nobel Peace Prize laureate from Finland spoke out some months back and said, you know, in 2012, Russia put on the table in negotiations over Syria a plan that would have involved Assad stepping down peacefully, nonviolently, a peace plan. And the United States State Department, and they do not deny this, immediately brushed it aside in preference for what they saw as the imminent violent overthrow of Assad, which they preferred. Now, why would you prefer a violent overthrow and delude yourself week after week after week for years that it was imminent to a guaranteed agreement of a nonviolent change in government. You know, when everyone knows and no one disputes that violent changes in government are shorter lived and have less
true.
Beneficial impacts and greater disasters and greater immediate suffering through the violence. Well, the United States is not seeking peace and democracy in Syria any more than it's seeking peace and democracy when it arms Saudi Arabia and helps it bomb families in Yemen, or when it arms brutal dictators in Bahrain or Jordan or Egypt or Israel or anywhere else. You know, was Bashar al-Assad an evil dictator back in the good old days when he was torturing people for the CIA? Or did he become an evil dictator when he resisted the will of the U.S. government and when the U.S. government saw in its plans the step needed of overthrowing the Syrian government before the Iranian government and right after the Iraqi government, which was supposed to happen but got delayed by the Iraqi resistance? You know, of course he was a nasty dictator to begin with, and still is.
Yes.
On a global scale, doesn't compare to many nasty dictators the United States is arming and supporting, much less to the crimes of the U.S. government itself. But sure, he's a horrible ruler, and was, but the U.S. desire to overthrow him violently rather than peacefully is based in the desire to kick Russia out of Syria, to take over Syria, to control Syria and any pipelines of fossil fuels that should come through it. And you know, to say that, well, now there's a greater cause of attacking ISIS, you know, has some sense and some nonsense to it. You had a reporter asked a U.S. State Department spokesman in Washington, and you can watch the video several weeks back now, if the Syrian government manages to retake the city of Palmyra from ISIS, will that be a good thing or a bad thing? And you know, 99% of people in the United States would say, oh, a good thing.
Sure.
Because to them, ISIS is, you know, Satan incarnate,
right,
whereas the Syrian government is just a government that, like, three Americans and a dog have been scared of, and nobody else has, you know, has been horrified of, despite every effort by John Kerry and Barack Obama. But this State Department spokesman refused to answer the question and made very clear that he did not want, you know, ISIS weakened in any way if it meant strengthening the Syrian government, because for them, the top goal still remains overthrowing the Syrian government. So you have ISIS created by the destruction of Iraq and the destruction
Absolutely.
Of Syria and the of Libya and the destruction of Syria too, and you know, driving around in U.S. Humvees with U.S. weapons taken from Iraq, taken from other groups, received directly from the United States, support given by the Saudis and Turkey with the U.S. looking the other way, and so forth. You know, should the United States actually turn against the more evil enemy and attack ISIS rather than the Syrian government, as Russia so admirably did? I mean, this is the position even of many friends of mine, peace activists, who denounce all violence until the Russians engage in it. Well, no, because ISIS wants the United States to attack it. It boosts its recruitment
Absolutely.
Incredibly.
Yeah.
It further destroys and impoverishes that region of the world, leaving people with fewer options but to support ISIS. And it is counterproductive on its own terms, as top U.S. commanders blurt out the day after they retire. You should disarm ISIS. You should disarm the region. You should stop allowing funding of ISIS, and you should work for a ceasefire that doesn't require that all parties agree that Assad must go before they sit down to the table. You know, and this is what we don't seem to understand in the United States, that the majority of the weapons in that supposedly inherently backward part of the globe are manufactured in the United States.
And
we've got toddlers in the United States killing a lot more Americans with guns than any foreign terrorists. than all foreign terrorists put together, with all weapons you can imagine. But we don't think of toddlers as inherently violent and backward and start bombing them and whoever's nearby the preschool, right? Because it's not their fault the guns are lying around. Well, you know, it's not ISIS's fault that Iraq was destroyed and Libya was destroyed and the region was, you know, saturated with U.S. weaponry. ISIS are adults. There's no excuse for their horrific crimes. But to see the other side of the picture, to see that their nastiness and their violence would do far less damage if they weren't armed to the teeth with U.S.-made weaponry, you know, it's really not that difficult.
Yeah, it's putting blinders
people
on
people to understand. And the U.S. could apply pressure and disarm and cease the shipment of any weaponry into that region if it chose.
But weapons, I mean, let's face it, you know, they're exceedingly profitable. We're talking about the U.S. provoking Russia. And I wonder, you know, the U.S. is sending a lot of weapons for Saudi Arabia to use against the people of Yemen. Now, Russia is backing Iran in its support of the popular uprising in Yemen. Do you have any reason to believe that the U.S. could be intentionally using this as a proxy war, as a way to poke a stick in Russia's eye? I mean, it's very odd here. I mean, it does seem a proxy war. The U.S. on one side, Russia's on the other side. Iran is right there with Russia as the bad guy too, but Iran is also fighting ISIS. What's going on with this Yemen situation? Is the U.S. intentionally provoking Russia there?
There are certainly those in the weapons industries who don't mind, who don't object to any U.S. provocation of Russia, risk of nuclear apocalypse notwithstanding. Whether that's driven U.S. policy for the past several years is a more difficult question. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had the President of the United States apparently deluding himself that a drone war in Yemen would make Yemen a better, safer, more democratic place. Now, did he really think that? I don't know, but millions of Americans did. And I had people come up to me and tell me, not only I prefer drone wars because in drone wars nobody gets killed, you know, nobody meaning that 4% of humanity you're supposed to care about, but also look at Yemen where you have a successful drone war, and this from the President of the United States as well, where what you had in fact, and you had Yemenis testifying to this before Congress over years. What you had, in fact, as many of us saw as predictable and predicted, was drone strikes creating anarchy and for terrorist groups and the rise of rebellious terrorist groups in Yemen. Drone strikes doing for terrorists what the terrorists never could have done for themselves, and empowering Al-Qaeda in Yemen for years, and leading, predictably, as some of us predicted, to other types of war, to now a ground war where you have U.S. troops on the ground in Yemen. We call them special forces, and I'm sure they're very, very special, but they are ground troops with boots on the ground in Yemen, as now in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan and Libya. You know, all of these ground wars primed for escalation by whatever U.S. president comes next or the current one. And so although the worsening of the situation in Yemen and the escalation into a major air war by Saudi Arabia and the United States was foreseeable, whether it was desired as the first choice by the U.S. president and everyone involved, I don't know, but it was foreseeable, and there was no concerted effort to avoid it. And you now have these slight steps in the right direction, like holding off on any more illegal cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia for the moment, you know, without joining the rest of the world in banning that weapon. Mm-hmm. But you now have a candidate for the White House fraudulently claiming to have already won the nomination of her party, amazing, who, as Secretary of State, made it her mission to waive all restrictions on selling Boeing airplanes to Saudi Arabia, receiving 900 $1,000 from Boeing into her family foundation at the time, having received over $10 million from Saudi Arabia, from a foreign government, into the Clinton family foundation, getting Saudi Arabia those planes that are now bombing families in Yemen and increasing the power of al-Qaeda in Yemen, campaigning as the candidate of, you know, good liberal progressivism for the White House.
It's amazing.
And the U.S. is usually oblivious.
And Victoria Nuland is rumored to be a choice for Secretary of State should Clinton prevail. I don't know if you heard that. I wonder if you could comment on who she is and what that might be like and how that might affect the situation with Russia.
This is a wife of a leading neocon. This is herself a leading neocon. This is someone who prominently, although unintentionally, was behind the facilitation of the coup in Ukraine. This is, you know, an all-out war hawk in favor of as much militarism and war as possible, who Hillary Clinton, yes, very well might put in charge of the so-called State Department, which under Hillary Clinton, when she ran the State Department, which Henry Kissinger says she ran better than anyone else in U.S. history, turned it largely into a marketing firm for U.S. corporations, yes, oil and fracking corporations imposing fracking on Eastern European countries and so forth, but largely weapons companies and State Department staff that spent their time pushing foreign governments to buy U.S. weaponry was a huge part of what the State Department did when Hillary Clinton was there. The rest of it was serving as a arm of the U.S. military, pushing for, she was the big force behind overthrowing the government of Libya.
Yes.
And when U.S. allies sodomized the president with a knife and killed him, she went on TV and giggled and laughed and said, yes, we came, we saw, he died, he, as Libya was thrown into chaos.
Yes.
And as
she owns
CIA
that.
Worked with the State Department to funnel weapons into Syria, which then led to that attack on the U.S. Embassy facility in Libya, in Benghazi. So Hillary is one of the most dangerous candidates for president we have seen probably ever. Another is, of course, Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And you've got 60% of the U.S. public which can't stand either one of them, which is also a record. So this is, you know, this is not a fun election season, although it's, you know, a great distraction for so many people.
There is huge enthusiasm for another candidate. We don't have to say who that is. But, you know, I saw there was a recent open letter from Russians living in the U.S. They say the U.S. leadership has done everything it could to push the situation to the brink of disaster. The letter goes on to say that the U.S. and the Saudis are supporting Wahhabin terrorists in Chechnya, which Saudis are Wahhabists. And they also say the sole reason why the USA and Russia have found themselves on a collision course instead of diffusing tensions and cooperating a wide range of international problems is a stubborn refusal by the U.S. leadership to accept Russia as an equal partner. End of quote. Well, they say Washington is dead set on being the world leader and the indispensable nation, even as its influence steadily dwindles in the wake of a string of foreign policy and military disasters, such as we've spoken, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. Your comments on that, I mean, this letter from a lot of Russians living in the U.S., it's surprising to me that the U.S. would still be doing this. But then again, I mean, what is the explanation? Maybe I'll continue, pardon my going on here. Would you agree with their statement in the letter that, quote, there is no objective reason why the U.S. and Russia should consider each other as adversaries?
Well, if the U.S. and Russia and the U.S. and the other 190-some nations don't start viewing each other as partners in cooperation, the fate of the planet for humanity is in grave danger from environmental destruction and from nuclear apocalypse. So there is every reason for the United States to reverse its position, and it has been the United States primarily pushing the aggressive, hostile stance toward Russia. While Putin came in as a force for reconciliation and moderation and challenging the hardliners and the neocons in his country, taking steps to forgive U.S. abuses and cooperate with the United States, and what he got in return was demonization and slander and libel and aggression of the sort we haven't seen in decades, which has led organizations in the United States to start taking Americans on friendship-building trips to Russia in a way that we haven't seen in decades. That started up in the early 80s when nobody was going to the evil empire. If people go to my website, davidswanson.org, they'll see an article I just wrote about an organization that did this in the 80s and 90s and has started doing it again. There's nothing we need more than actual human contact and citizen diplomacy and friendship building between the United States and this most dangerous of its targeted so-called enemies.
And growing up in the 50s, there was a lot of fear of the bad guys, the Soviets, the Iron Curtain, all that, dropping a bomb on us and ending life everywhere as we know it. I'm hoping you have some degree of hope and optimism that people across the world are waking up to this and might, if Hillary Clinton should somehow use the fear of Trump, which is pretty reasonable fear, and become elected, do you think we will go to war directly with Russia, or we'll just keep it sort of, by proxies and other ways of doing it?
Oh, I think it's entirely possible. Before, in the next 8 months, before the next president is installed, although everyone sort of acts like it's already happened, and I think it's entirely possible under a president, Clinton, Trump, or Sanders. I think it's significantly less likely with a President Sanders, but, the proliferation of the weaponry, the hostility on both sides now, and the accident-prone nature of this weaponry. We've survived as a planet due to the lucky escape from numerous accidents since nuclear weapons were created. Yeah, it's possible. The non-nuclear states are taking tremendous strides toward creating a new treaty to ban nuclear weapons, to put pressure on the nuclear states to at least start complying with the non-proliferation treaty that requires that they disarm of nuclear weapons, and they're not doing it. I don't frankly take a lot of interest in whether I should be hopeful or gloomy. I think I have a moral responsibility to do what needs to be done in the best way I can figure out, and I find that much more enjoyable than not doing it. But if for people who are sort of hope dependent, please don't invest that in some godforsaken candidate for emperor to install in the White House. I mean, you saw the depression that created in you 8 years ago, right, when you did that with someone else. Invested in the work of people, organizations, media outlets like this one, groups like I mentioned that are taking people to visit Russia and Russians to visit the States. Put your hope in something legitimately useful and build it up from there.
Sounds like a good, good idea. David Swanson, thank you so much. Warisacrime.org and what was the other? World Beyond War. What other websites? Oh, davidswanson.org.
Yeah, beyondwar.org, warisacrime.org, davidswanson.org.
Thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thanks, Bert.
Talking World War III blues. An old Bob Dylan song.
Went to the doctor the very next day to see what kind of words he could say. He said it was a bad dream. I wouldn't worry about it none, though. Them old dreams are only in your head. I said, hold it, doctor, World War passed through my brain. He said, nurse, get your pad, the boy's insane. He grabbed my arm, I said, ouch, as I landed on the psychiatric couch. He said, tell me about it. Well, things started at 3 o'clock fast. It was all over by 4:15. I was down in the sewer with some little lover when I peeked out from a manhole cover, wondering who turned the lights on us.